You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Milwaukee Bucks finished this season with the best record in the NBA and the number one seed for the playoffs. We recap the year that was and look ahead to the postseason. Now, voters in Wisconsin approved two referendums last week that amended the state constitution when it comes to the cash bail system. The amendments focus on the conditions under which a person can be held in custody on cash bail and the factors a judge can consider in setting the bail amount. After the referendums passed, Governor Tony Evers signed onto a law that was passed by the Republican-controlled state legislature. It clarifies where and how these constitutional amendments will be applied. The bill had some bipartisan support, but opponents of the changes fear that the cash bail system will be harder on low-income offenders compared to those who can afford to pay a higher cash amount. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you vote to support those amendments to the cash bail system? Why or why not? What are you hoping to see change as a result? Do you think these changes go far enough? Do you have questions about the bail system, how it works, what it's meant for? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Cecilia Klingel is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, where she teaches criminal law, constitutional criminal procedures, sentencing, and corrections. Cecilia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
I have read and heard, Cecilia, a lot of different reads on how big a deal these changes are. What is your take on that? How much actually changes with these now passed and signed into law?
I think we'll have to wait to see how much judges rely on these changes in law. They certainly do, however, pretty significantly expand the ability of judges to use cash bond in criminal cases.
Can you talk about the original intent of cash bonds and bail systems? My understanding was it wasn't so much about the threat a criminal suspect might have to the public. It was a threat that they might not show up for their trial.
That is correct. And I think there's a lot of public confusion on this point. Often when people want to see cash bond used in criminal cases, what they really mean is that they think people shouldn't be released pre-trial, that they have safety concerns about people who aren't yet convicted being in the community while they're waiting to go to trial and be convicted or acquitted from criminal charges. But because people who have been charged with crimes haven't been found guilty yet of committing a crime, we presume them to be innocent. And innocent people don't get to be detained except in very special circumstances. We do have a law in Wisconsin, like most states, that under certain circumstances says that people can be held without any kind of bond whatsoever. However, most people charged with most crimes are supposed to be released into the community. And what we can do is have conditions that we place on them that are designed to keep people reasonably safe. Cash bond is one of those conditions that can be imposed, but the way it works usually is that it's supposed to incentivize people's appearance in court to make sure that they actually do show up and let the state make its case against them. And so for that reason, if people don't show up and they've been required to pay cash, they'll forfeit it. That's the way it's supposed to work. It's not supposed to, however, be set in an amount that people couldn't reasonably pay.
One concern that people have been raising for years is if you rely on cash bond, it could create, in effect, a two-tier justice system. An offender without lots of money stays in jail until their trial. A person with sufficient amount of money can walk free until their trial. How big a concern do you see that being?
That is a real concern, and there is good research that suggests that, in fact, that is what happens. Although the law requires that bail be set in reasonable amounts, reasonable is a broad term, and for many people, even a small or modest amount of cash bond may be more than they're able to come up with. The majority of people who are processed by the criminal system are people of very little financial means. And as a result, even modest cash bond amounts may be too much and people will sit detained. We know that when people are detained, all sorts of things happen. They can lose their jobs and their homes. They're more likely to plead guilty, not just because of the charges against them, but because it's harder often to develop facts to use in one's defense and for other reasons as well. And so it is a real concern that people who have money and can post bond are often at an advantage throughout the criminal process compared to those who can't. That can create inequity and also create other concerns too about who it is that we release and under what conditions.
Talking to Cecilia Klingel, associate professor at the UW Law School, looking at bail, cash bail in Wisconsin. Two constitutional amendments related to that issue passed last week, implementing laws signed into effect also last week. You can join in with your thoughts on that. Are you happy to see these changes? Do you have concerns about them? Do you have questions about how all this actually works in practice? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And if you've participated in this, if you have been subject to a cash bond yourself, or you've been a victim of a crime where the perpetrator was, or you work in the system, love to hear your experience at 800-642-1234. Cecilia, the concern, part of the concern that drove this came from the Waukesha Christmas vehicle attack. The perpetrator there had been out on what people perceived to be a low bail that didn't take into account a history of violence. What do you make of that concern that if we don't take these things into account enough, we may put the public at risk?
Well, so I think a few things. One, it's always a little bit dangerous to make law based on very unusual cases. That said, it's true that we need to be attentive to public safety concerns and that it does happen in our system that sometimes people who are accused of crimes but not yet convicted have past histories and may be facing current charges that implicate the safety of individuals within the community. My concern is that the answer to that is not necessarily broadening cases in which we use cash bond, because again, cash isn't meant to detain people, but rather it would be examining that other statute that I mentioned that allows us under certain circumstances to deny release altogether and not simply make it available to those who have more means than others. That statute we haven't amended, and there have been criticisms that it is both too narrow in some ways and that it's a little bit procedurally clunky in others. And that might have been a better place to focus our reform efforts.
On a related note, one of the changes that did happen was changing a phrase from serious bodily harm to now just serious harm in assessing a bail amount, again, with that risk to the public in mind. Is that a significant change, taking out that one word, bodily, and just saying serious harm?
So it might be, and that doesn't just apply to cash, that applies to the conditions that are set. So serious bodily harm is a term that isn't defined by the statute specifically, but that some judges took to mean that they could only set conditions for people on bond when we thought that they posed a risk of injuring people to in a really serious and protracted way. Of course, we want to be attentive to other kinds of harm as well. And also, again, I keep coming back to the fact that we presume that people are innocent. We don't get to punish them before they're convicted. And so what I think the legislature was trying to do was give judges a little bit more discretion in setting all kinds of conditions, both cash and other restrictions on people's liberty, in cases where they had concerns about harm to the community, but not necessarily harm that would land someone in a hospital, for example. Now, of course, you can make that too broad and, again, restrict people's liberty in a way that's punitive, which we're not supposed to do under the law. And I think that we will, again, have to rely, as we often do in the criminal system, on the wise use of discretion by prosecutors and by judges in not setting conditions that are overly restrictive.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi. Say, I was wondering if your guest could perhaps speak to the advent of the bail bonds industry and their impact on whether they would be for or against the cash bail system, the pros and cons of that. It seems to me that, you know, they may have a kind of a clear agenda in these people remaining in jail or going to jail and receiving a cash bond just because it's advantageous for a business. So maybe Chris, if you could speak to that a little bit.
Thanks for the call. And Cecilia, you know, we see in the movies those bail bondsmen, usually called bail bondsmen. We don't have that exactly here in Wisconsin, do we?
We do not. You are correct. We are one of only several states that does not permit the use of bail bondsmen. And I think that that's something we should probably be proud of because the caller is correct. That there are all sorts of incentives that can enter the system when we have profit motives involved that aren't focused on kind of the core concerns of bail, which again is making sure that people show up to court in order to answer for the charges against them. One thing that we have seen here in Wisconsin without the use of bail bonds, people, is that when our judges do set bond, it tends to be in more modest amounts than we might see in jurisdictions where bail bonds people often will take on the role of posting bond, but then people are required to pay them usually some fraction of the full bond amount. That tends to drive up the amount that courts often set for bond. And we don't have that kind of inflation in our courts, which seems to me a good thing.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to UW-Madison Law Professor Cecilia Klingel about the state's cash bail system and how it changes after two constitutional amendments passed in last week's election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think the cash bail system should work in Wisconsin? Or would you like to see something apart from that? More of a question of, okay, is it safe to have this person or in public or not? Forget the money side of it. How would you like to see that evaluated? What questions do you have for our guest about how all of this works? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Cecilia Klingel. She teaches about criminal law and procedure as an associate professor in the UW Law School. With us today to explore how cash bail works in Wisconsin and how it's changing after voters approved a pair of constitutional amendments last week. Still time for you to join in with your questions, your thoughts on the outcome of those votes, your maybe experiences with that system at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Gary is with us in Brookfield. Gary, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions for the guest. The first question is, I had the perception that up until the referendum and reading up on the referendum, that judges were allowed to take into consideration the crime and the past history of the individual who committed the crime when they set bail. And I'm wondering if the reason why I had that perception has to do, did Wisconsin differ from other states in America because of that? And so that was the perception. I will admit, I didn't think that, I thought judges could take that into consideration, and I learned because of the referendum that that wasn't the case.
Gary, thanks a lot for the call. Cecilia, did judges, pre-referendum, have some of that discretion that Gary's talking about?
So they did. You weren't wrong, Gary. Here's how it worked. Before the amendment passed, there were three reasons and only three reasons why judges could choose to impose cash bond and other conditions too. One is so the reason you could impose cash was if someone was going to fail to appear in court. You could impose conditions of any kind if also there was a concern about the intimidation of witnesses or that someone was going to cause serious bodily harm to someone during that pretrial period. What the amendments have done is expand the list of considerations for when you can impose conditions, including cash bond, to a broader range of circumstances. But even before the amendment, of course, judges, when deciding whether or not you are likely to intimidate witnesses or cause serious bodily harm, or even fail to appear in court, would often look at your history. So for example, a common scenario would be that if someone has a history of escape charges, then and a history of failure not to appear in court, then it would have been more likely that that person was going to receive cash bond from the very beginning. And in deciding whether the other factors had been met, someone's criminal history would also have been considered. The amendment just makes that explicit and, again, sort of broadens the range of circumstances in which any kind of condition can be imposed and cash can be used.
Thanks for the call, Gary. And Cecilia, Gary wondering, in general, how does Wisconsin compare to other states in the practical use of those that discretionary power? We already talked about the bail bond system, which we don't have in Wisconsin. Anything else stand out to you notable about Wisconsin versus the rest of the country?
Well, bond is a really big topic of law reform right now. I think one thing that is notable is that our state just expanded the circumstances in which courts can impose cash bond, whereas the general trend in law reform is toward limiting the circumstances in which cash can be used. So this is a little bit against the grain of the momentum that we're seeing around the country. But again, it's an area of just great flux in the law. And I think states are experimenting broadly with different approaches to bond.
A big question, Cecilia, is does changing our cash bond system one way or another affect public safety? I'm guessing there's probably been research on that. It's probably a tough subject to research. Do we know much?
Well, I think we know a lot about little pieces, right? And the thing about crime is that it's not monolithic. Every crime is unique. There are different patterns among people who are perpetrating crime. Like misdemeanors are not the same as felony offenses. Crimes that involve interpersonal violence are not the same as crimes that are committed when people are having a mental health crisis or other complicated situational factors. And so because of that, you can't give one simple answer to the question of public safety. I think what we do know, though, is that looking at case-specific facts and making decisions about imposing conditions that are narrowly tailored to the facts in front of us is helpful in making sure that our system is both protecting our community as reasonably as we can, while also making sure that we're paying attention to people's procedural rights and that we're being fair in the way that we're deciding criminal cases and limiting the liberty of people who are accused of committing crime.
You know, it sounds like a judge might have a fair amount of discretion here. And awaiting trial, my outcome is going to be pretty different when it comes to cash bail and release if I get this judge or the one in the next county or even the one in the next courtroom. How much variability is there from one judge to the next?
I mean, decision makers matter, right? Our selection of judges matters. Our selection of prosecutors matters. And we do in the American criminal legal system rely heavily on the wise and prudent judgment, the discretion of people who have been charged with exercising authority, so prosecutors and judges in particular, and what you're charged with, even when we look at police, whether you're arrested, whether your case is referred for criminal charging, all of these things can vary depending on the decision maker who's in front of us, which is why it's really important that we have public servants who are paying attention to the law and thinking wisely about how to balance all of these competing interests.
We heard from Anna in Janesville who couldn't stay on the line. She's wondering if there will be an impact on taxpayers if more people are being held in jails on cash bond instead of being released. Is that a possible impact?
Well, the mechanism by which that would happen would be that if we're detaining more people, obviously our jails would then be more full and they would have more capacity constraints. We'd have to think about either expanding them or thinking about alternatives to traditional detention. And certainly that has implications for taxpayers. Again, we're worry in a time when people are generally across the country trying to think about how to rely less on incarceration, particularly for pretrial populations, people who haven't been convicted of any offense yet. And I think that those kinds of conversations are going to continue. And depending on how much judges choose to impose cash bond, the new law change allows them to do so, but it doesn't require them to do so. However, if we have more people detained, then yes, our counties are going to have difficult conversations about how to make sure that we're detaining people in a way that's humane.
In our last minute and a half or so, Cecilia, we've mentioned a couple times, you know, there's cash bail, but you mentioned there are other conditions that a judge can impose when someone is released and awaiting trial. What are some examples of those kind of conditions that might be put on someone?
So there's a wide range, everything from curfews to limits on locations that people can go. Often there can be limits on people with whom you can interact. So it's very common, for example, to bar people from interacting with co-defendants or with the putative victims of their crimes. Things of that nature. It can include sometimes things like GPS monitoring, restrictions on the consumption of alcohol or other substances, things of that nature.
Briefly, Cecilia, what are you watching for as these constitutional amendments come into practice?
So I'm going to be really interested to see to what degree it actually changes the practice of our magistrate judges in setting bond. Again, as I said earlier, the new changes give judges wider discretion in making decisions about what conditions to, when to impose conditions, what conditions to impose, and whether or not to use cash. But we don't know yet how, if at all, actual practice will be affected by these legal changes.
Cecilia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Cecilia Klingel, associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, where she teaches on criminal law, constitutional criminal procedure, sentencing, and corrections. She was with us today to look at how the state constitutional amendments passed last week by voters will change the cash bail system here in Wisconsin. You can keep sharing your thoughts, maybe your experiences in that system, at ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Wisconsin will be the movie capital of the world starting Thursday at the Wisconsin Film Festival. Join Kate and her guests for a preview and learn about the movie scene here in Wisconsin. Maybe find out what you want to see coming up. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. If you like to go out dancing and you really like to dress up for it, have I got a suit for you? Well, I don't have it. It's up for auction and it's expected to go for about $200,000. As reported by CNN, one of the white suits worn by John Travolta in the disco-centered film Saturday Night Fever is on the auction block. Now, even if you haven't seen the movie, you'd probably recognize this suit. It's white, three pieces, lots of polyester, big lapels, oversized pockets. This baby's got it all. What size is it? The article doesn't say, so I guess it's, you know, John Travolta size, circa 1977. The movie helped supercharge the rise of disco music and dancing. And if you wear this suit, you can help bring it back. Disco never died. This is Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk to the co-hosts of NPR's podcast White Lies and WPR's podcast Uprooted about what became of the tens of thousands of Cuban exiles who fled the island and made their way to the United States and to Wisconsin in 1980. Now, the Milwaukee Bucks wrapped up their season yesterday with a loss to the Toronto Raptors, but they finished the regular season with the best record in the NBA and the top seed in the upcoming playoffs. The team is currently the betting favorite to win the NBA Finals. It'd be their second in the last three seasons, if so. We're looking back at another big season for Milwaukee and ahead to what the postseason could bring. Justin Garcia is a studio host and analyst for the Milwaukee Bucks Radio Network and WTMJ in Milwaukee. Justin, thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
Regardless of what comes out of the playoffs, how are you going to remember this Bucks regular season?
I'll remember this regular season, obviously, with more of the individual greatness from Giannis, but this felt like the year of the role player for the Bucks, and really Drew Holiday taking a big step forward as well. When we talked last year about all the games missed for this team, specifically Brooke Lopez, and how that really took their defense from elite to middle of the pack, you thought, okay, the worst is behind us. It can't be that bad in terms of injuries ever again. And this year was worse. When you look at the man games lost, Giannis missed nearly 20 games. You had Chris Middleton, who played in less than half of the team's games this season. You had Drew Holiday in and out, and then a couple of injuries towards the end. Despite all that, if I would have told you at the beginning of the year, here's the games that these key players will miss, nobody would have thought the Bucks would be the number one seed in the East or all of basketball. And I think the reason why is because of those role players. A guy like Javon Carter was huge for this team all throughout the season. Bobby Portis as well, who has a strong chance to be the sixth man of the year. It was all those guys, and Grayson Allen taking a big step forward as well. So it wasn't just the stars for the Bucks this year, and that's one of the things I'll remember most.
That said, how are the stars looking health-wise as they get ready for postseason?
Well, Giannis and Drew Holiday certainly look good, and Brooke Lopez as well. When we mention awards, I mean, he's one of the front runners for Defensive Player of the Year, which is astounding for a man who just turned 35 in a league that's getting younger and younger and who just had back surgery a year ago. But I think the big one you're hinting at is Chris Middleton. By all accounts, they feel relatively good. I mean, it's been a long onboarding process for Chris this season, but having, you know, a week plus off in the case of the last time he played, and now with the play-in tournament, the Bucks finished up the regular season yesterday. They're not going to play again until Sunday. So getting that extra week off and then the last few games as well is going to be key for not only Chris, but even Grayson Allen and Pat Connaughton, who both missed some time. So all things considered, they are in a very good spot going into the postseason, where you have, you know, knock on wood, no major issues. You're just waiting on some guys to return to the lineup, and this week off should be great for that.
Giannis Antetokounmpo, two-time NBA MVP. Should he be the third?
Well, I would assume you'd think I'm biased here, but I think he is the MVP. But, you know, I've said all along, and I think most of us have kind of agreed, he is the best player in the league. He is certainly the best two-way player out there. And I think if you surveyed a number of front office executives as well and said, hey, you're starting your own team, you get one pick, who are you choosing? Giannis would be the overwhelming favorite, even going into the postseason. I think Giannis and a guy like Kevin Durant are who you would look at most. If I can give you one player, who do you want? That being said, the way this works is it's a narrative award, and a lot of times it's about when is it your turn. Giannis had those two MVPs. His team didn't win a championship. That was held against him. So then it was Nikola Jokic's turn, and now he's going through the same thing where he won two MVPs. His team lost in the postseason early. So now we look to Joel Embiid, and I've said it's a turns thing. I don't want to discredit what Joel Embiid has done, because that's one of the other remarkable things is you have three generational talents in Giannis, Jokic, and Embiid turning in individually three of the best seasons we've seen in the history of this league. The unfortunate part is they coincide in the same season and you can only pick one.
Just 10 seconds left. I say Bucks in six. How far do you think they're going to go, Justin?
Well, it depends on how they match up with, I think, the Boston Celtics. If you can cure some of that perimeter issues that we saw in the last matchup, I like their chances, certainly early and against any team coming out of the West.
Justin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Anytime.
That's Justin Garcia, studio host and analyst from the Milwaukee Bucks Radio Network and WTMJ in Milwaukee, with us for a look ahead at the Bucks postseason. Now it's Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a feature about Short Story Night.
Tons of people are in book clubs these days. Groups of friends get together to talk about a particular autobiography or critique a mystery novel's plotline or drink wine. Perhaps you're someone who wishes they could join a book club but says, how does anyone have time for this? If you are, there's hope, because a Fox Valley librarian has created a monthly event at a local brewery to help even the busiest people continue to be lifelong readers. WPR's Joe Schultz has more on how Short Story Nights have fostered a sense of community for 5 years.
A room with a small stage in Lion's Tail Brewing in Neenah is packed on a Monday. People from all walks of life filter into the brewery to discuss a different short story every month. A murmur begins to fill the room. Then, librarian Richie Zaporowski takes the stage with a microphone.
Hey, I'm Richie from the Nina Public Library. Thanks for coming out, everyone. This is our fifth anniversary here. Yes. I'm here for 5 years, so let's give it up for 5 years.
Zaborowski hosts short story nights. It's kind of like a book club, but instead of reading a book each month, the group reads one or sometimes a few short stories. Tonight, they're talking about a pair of short stories that center around second-generation immigrants.
This is a story about the mother trying to assimilate into the American culture in a different way, and the daughter...
Zaborowski had the idea for short story nights shortly after becoming a parent. He had two small children at home and wanted to start a traditional book club, but just didn't have the time to read a whole book. He was too busy.
There's people who may not have time for a traditional book club, so this would be a perfect option for them.
Thus, short story nights were born. During the event, Zaborowski leads a conversation about the book. There's also a trivia portion where attendees answer questions tied to the story's theme, and sometimes attendees even interview the authors of the short story they're discussing.
The short story night really produced a great community. You hear about those third spaces all the time. Where can people get together nowadays? And this, I think, is a great third space for people.
Regular attendees agreed with Zaborowski's sentiments about the community forged discussing literature over adult beverages. A few of those attendees are Doug Middleton, Jill Harmon, and Mark Newman.
Because when I first came, other than this guy here, I didn't know anybody. You know, and I've gotten to know people, you know, the ones that are sort of regulars. It's always fun to sit at a table where I don't know anybody.
People come here from throughout the valley, and it's just a lot of fun seeing them again.
We get to, you know, visit with people, like-minded, you know, they're literary, and you get to talk about concepts, and, you know, I'm not watching college basketball, so it's a nice break.
While they all come for the camaraderie, many admit that Zaborowski's infectious personality is what keeps them coming back. Just ask Harmon.
I'm a big fan of Richie's. He started out almost being a stand-up comic. He'd tell us jokes about his family.
For others, like Pat Rosnick, the back and forth between the audience and Zaborowski is what makes the event fun.
We love to come and give Richie a hard time.
And Zaborowski says the attendees are what keep him energized month in and month out.
I can't say enough about the group. They're just a great group, and they're a lot of fun. And like I said, no one takes it too seriously. We have a great discussion. Everyone listens to each other and where they're coming from, and it's been wonderful.
Aside from the friendships forged, short story nights also give people of all perspectives the opportunity to talk about current events through the lens of literature.
Focusing on contemporary stories really allows us to have a conversation that spans all walks of life, and I think it is a safe space where people can get together and voice their opinions.
Whether young or old, rich or poor, Zaborowski says Short Story Night is an accessible way to enjoy literature and forge friendships. And the adult beverages don't hurt either.
WPR's Joe Schultz brought us that piece on Short Story Nights in Nina. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, podcasts from NPR and from Wisconsin Public Radio uncover the stories of the Cubans who made their way to the United States in 1980 in what became known as the Mariel Boatlift. We'll look at the lives of the thousands of Cuban exiles who came through Fort McCoy here in Wisconsin. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Back in 1980, more than 100,000 people fled Cuba and made the treacherous journey across the Florida Straits and into the United States. They landed in Key West as part of the Mariel Boatlift, a brief period when Cuban President Fidel Castro opened his borders, allowing Cubans to leave the island. About 15,000 of those exiles were sent to Fort McCoy in western Wisconsin. Many were processed before moving in with family or finding sponsors. Some were detained indefinitely by the U.S. government. Some of those people are featured in the podcast from Wisconsin Public Radio, WPR Reports Uprooted, hosted by UW La Crosse professor Omar Granados and WPR's Maureen McCollum. Cuban exiles from the Mariel Boatlift are also the focus of the new season of NPR's White Lies podcast, co-hosted by Andrew Beck Grace. I talked to Maureen and Andrew about their reporting earlier today. Andrew, what got you started on the investigations that led you to share these stories of Cuban exiles from the Mariel boat lift?
Well, my partner Chip Brantley and I found this cache of photographs of a prison riot in Alabama in 1991. And it was just a very curious situation where these men had taken over this prison. We found out it was Cuban men who'd all been detained for various, some had committed crimes, but many of them had been detained with no charge, without due process, simply because they were deemed to be ineligible to be admitted into the country. And some of them had been in prison for over a decade. So just finding out about this little toehold we got from the story from this prison riot that happened in 1991, and then realizing there was a much larger, more intense story about our immigration system, about who has the right to have rights, about how we determine these things, we sort of fell down in journalism. You know, we think about this sort of rabbit hole. We sort of fell down the rabbit hole at that point.
And Maureen, we've been listening to your pieces here in Wisconsin. What got you started on these stories of the many of these Cuban exiles who ended up here in Wisconsin?
When I was a student at UW La Crosse, I had found out that during the Mariel boat lift in 1980, when about 125,000 Cubans had come over, about 15,000 of those Cubans had been sent to Fort McCoy in southwest Wisconsin, which is about 45 minutes from La Crosse. And I started looking into it more, and I couldn't read enough on it. But what was so interesting was that when I would find newspaper articles and remembrances of what happened during this time when all these people came through Fort McCoy, it seemed like there weren't many stories about from the Cubans themselves and what their experience was like there, what their experience was like in Cuba. And fast forward to 2020, I made connections with a handful of guys who came through Fort McCoy, ended up putting their roots down in the La Crosse community and staying in La Crosse. And I interviewed them for a Wisconsin Life story just to better understand their lives. And we realized pretty quickly it was a story that was impossible to tell in about 4 minutes. So it turned into a podcast. And what ultimately we wanted to do was, like I said, just better understand what it was that these people went through during their life experience. What was it like growing up in Cuba under Fidel Castro? What was it like making that boat ride across the Florida Straits? What was it like going through Fort McCoy? And more importantly, what has their life been like in Wisconsin since they've decided to settle down here? It really hasn't been easy. And I'm really grateful that they shared their life experience with us.
I want to hear some of those voices. Andrew, you talked to Ernesto Asiego More about his time at Fort McCoy. He told you heard here through an interpreter about how he ended up in a federal penitentiary.
He went through an interview with the INS, and he doesn't know why, but after that, the woman who had interviewed him told the guard to conduct him elsewhere. He refers to the place as a dog pound.
During the interview, when the INS agent asked if he'd ever been in prison in Cuba, he said, in an offhand way, everyone in Cuba has been in prison at some point. She seems to have taken that as an admission of some wrongdoing, because he was immediately detained at Fort McCoy and then sent to the federal prison in Atlanta.
And it turns out, Andrew, in your podcast, you find this was not an uncommon story. How frequently did this sort of thing happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's, as you might imagine, it's not something that the federal government kept great records on, because for all intents and purposes, whenever the press would ask about it, they would say, oh, we've done these comprehensive interviews of these entrants, and we have determined that they had criminal history back in Cuba, so we are going to detain them, basically. But when you get down into the anecdotal evidence of what's actually happening in the prisons at the time, and then the more important sort of legal evidence, you come to realize that it was a very frequent mistake that landed these folks in prison. One man that we tell almost spend a whole episode telling the story of, he basically signed his statement after he had been interviewed and was detained shortly thereafter. And when he finally gets to Atlanta and goes to he's there for 6 weeks without anybody even telling him why he's there. And he goes before an immigration judge, and the immigration judge says, well, you told the interviewer that you were a drug trafficker in Cuba. And he says, I don't know what you're talking about. That's not anything. I'm studying medicine in Cuba. I didn't say anything like that. But he had signed the statement that either the translator had acted maliciously or had just not understood Spanish. I mean, it was frequent that things like this would go wrong. But above and beyond that, what our government did in these cases was detain folks without any committing any crime in this country, all with just a suspicion of criminal activity in Cuba. And that became really interesting to us to sort of unpack through our investigation, was how was it that the federal government essentially made these decisions about these people without having any information from the Cuban authorities at a time when the Mariel Boatlift was creating a sort of national imagination about the sort of criminality that Fidel Castro had unleashed onto this country, and a pre-existing crime wave in South Florida had fed into those rumors. And so it was in many ways this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. And not to mention that about a third of the Boatlift was Afro-Cuban. So they sort of dovetailed. They were dark-skinned. They didn't speak English. Many of them were single men. They were working-class people. They sort of dovetailed into all these other sort of stereotypes of criminality and dangerousness that this country has. So I think that's really what we discovered in our investigation.
Talking to Andrew Beck-Grace, co-host of the NPR podcast White Lies, and Maureen McCollum, co-host and executive producer of the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted, looking at the Mariel Boatlift, Cuban immigrants to America, refugees, a number of different categories, their lives here in Wisconsin and around the country. Maureen, in your podcast, you give us a taste of life for these Cubans at Fort McCoy here in Wisconsin. I want to listen to Osvaldo Durruti about being at Fort McCoy. He told you about how he would pass the time.
There was a group, musician. We all got together. We started, you know, playing music. And that was when I ended up going to different places. And that was my way out of the environment, the McCoy. You know, I just want to get away. You know, you're going to meet people, new faces, Americans, and, you know.
Can you tell us more about what you learned about life at Fort McCoy for these Cuban exiles?
Right. So life at Fort McCoy was incredibly complicated. You know, we've heard from Andrew, and I'm so thankful for the reporting that him and his team did, because they were able to look into these stories about people who just sort of passed through Fort McCoy and then were sent elsewhere. I mean, we had heard these stories, but, you know, based on the people that we had talked with, we weren't able to do any of that reporting. So I'm really thankful that they were able to do that. People like Osvaldo, it's interesting, the people we talk with in Uprooted, this living at Fort McCoy is what they talk the least about. And I think there were a couple reasons for that. One, they don't want to remember. You know, we heard from the gentleman in Cuba who talked about how Fort McCoy is like a dog pound. We heard how from some of the people we talked with, there's one gentleman, Enrique Morey, who refers to Fort McCoy as the Wild West. There were, you know, at times it was a violent environment. There were assaults. There was corruption among security forces. But I also, I mean, it wasn't all horrible. It wasn't great for a lot of people, but it wasn't also horrible. Like, a lot of the time was actually quite mundane. They spent the time filling out paperwork, kind of waiting for family to come and get them out of there, waiting for sponsors to take them on and find homes for them in Wisconsin or elsewhere. And then, as Osvaldo talked about, he passed the time by playing music. So it was a really musical environment. There were a couple bands that were formed. They had musicians come in and perform. A lot of people played baseball. They played cards. A lot of friendships were formed. They had over 1,000 locals went and became staff at Fort McCoy during the time they were there. So there were a lot of friendships formed. We hear about people working in the mess hall and the cafeteria and finding sponsors just because they're working alongside, you know, a college student from Sparta. And that's one thing that we focus in on in Uprooted too, is just these friendships that were formed. So needless to say, Fort McCoy, it was complicated. It wasn't great. It was bad at times, but there was some good that came out of it.
And Andrew, I used a few different words in rapid succession there: refugees, exiles, immigrants. In legal terms, none of those, I think, is exactly right. And that's part of the story here, this ambiguous situation that these Cubans coming to the United States were in.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a sort of irony of the Boatlift that the Refugee Act of 1980 was passed just weeks before the Boatlift unfolded, which, you know, for many people watching the Boatlift unfold, they thought, well, this is perfect. We have this great new policy to deal with refugees. But it was not intended to deal with a massive influx of people coming across our shores. It was really intended to deal with people in third-party countries that we would essentially have a interview process with and determine how many we're going to bring and set up housing and bring them here. So they weren't refugees. They were technically asylum seekers, although the way they were treated by the immigration authorities and the special status they had essentially said that they were entrants. They had not, from a legal standpoint, the Mariel refugees had not entered the country, even though they were, by all accounts, here. And when they were in McCoy or when they were in Fort Chaffee, they were obviously inside the country. But from the legal perspective, they were asking for entrance into the country, and that determination had not yet been made. So that you can imagine that this put them in the most vulnerable position of anyone who is corporally, who's physically in this country. If the government doesn't think that you're here, then you have no protection. You have no constitutional rights. You have no due process. And that's really what endangered the folks that we sort of investigated and told the story of in White Lies.
And we'll leave it there. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
And Maureen, thanks for sharing your work with us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That was Maureen McCollum, co-host of the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted, and Andrew Beck Grace, co-host of the NPR podcast White Lies. They joined me earlier today for a look at what happened to the thousands of Cuban exiles who came to the U.S. and through Fort McCoy here in Wisconsin more than 30 years ago. You can find both links to both podcasts at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the diabetes drug Ozempic is being used for weight loss as well, with a lot of hype around it. A Wisconsin diabetes doctor tells us about the medication and what it means for diabetes treatment. And OPEC Plus cuts back in the oil supply. Jobs numbers wiggle but don't drop. We'll look at the latest economic news and what it means for you. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a new report takes a close look at health in Wisconsin and across the country, one county at a time, with a focus on civic life and how that can affect our well-being. Find out where Wisconsin's doing well and where there's room for improvement. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.